Are we recording?
Yes, we're recording. Go ahead.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of the Right Dishonourable podcast for 2016.
This is the first time that we've successfully gone into another year.
That's true.
Without, like, significant breaks.
Yes.
How was your Christmas?
It was lovely.
Or other religious or non-religious...
We've had this discussion before. I'm happy with calling it Christmas.
Okay, good.
You want to call it Happy Holidays or whatever?
No, I want to call it Winterfest.
Okay, because you hate America, right? That's the reason.
Yeah, what? I'm not sure. What's our point? Anyway, moving on. How was your New Year's?
It was good, yeah.
Excellent.
So we'll remember most of it.
I don't care. We're all caught up on that now. Excellent. Hello, listeners. Hope your New Year's was very good too, and your holiday period in general. My name is Jazza.
My name's Jimmy.
And although that was a very chaotic, like, minute to start the podcast with, we usually talk very eloquently about politics, social issues, and current events.
Very good.
Thank you. Good. We have some topics.
We actually have three of them, yeah, as per usual.
Yeah.
The first one, we will be discussing the Labour reshuffle, including the controversy about whether the BBC hates Labour.
The BBC. You definitely said BBC.
The BBC. Whether they orchestrated a resignation of a frontbencher, and the ongoing controversy around that.
The short of that is, they did, but nobody should care.
Okay, more on that later. The second topic we will be discussing concerns North Korea and their detonation of a nuclear weapon. And we'll be discussing whether they're lying about the size of their nuclear weapon, as it were.
Making it sound like a dating profile online. Are you lying about the size of your nuclear weapon, North Korea? Are you really?
I mean, we could go very far with that.
I'm sure we will.
And what it means for relations in Asia Pacific and more widely. And the last topic we will be discussing involves a report by the Hypei Centre regarding Fat Cat Tuesday, which is the time it takes for a FTSE 100 executive to earn as much money as you will in a year. If he was paid.
You being like the average human being.
Yeah, well, the average Briton, so not quite the average human being. I think the average human being, I'd probably earn that by Tuesday, you know. So, yeah, those are our three topics.
Shall we get into it then?
Yeah, we shall.
This week, Jeremy Corbyn, who is the leader of Labour, in case you didn't know, in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, he decided to shuffle his cabinet about a little bit. Shuffle around the shadow cabinet. And there were rumours and there were briefings for journalists before the winter break that this was going to be a revenge reshuffle and that a load of top players who were very vocal about their...
Criticisms
of Corbyn and his leadership and his politics, there were rumours that he was going to move them out and some of the...
Or sack them. Yeah, some might say.
Some might put it in that way. And there were rumours of Hilary Benn, who is the Foreign Secretary, and made a very rousing speech when there was the debate about whether or not the UK was going to bomb Syria.
Bomb Iraq.
No, Syria.
Oh, sorry, yeah, or Syria.
There have been
a lot of debates, man.
Yeah, I know that we've been off the horse for a good couple of weeks, but come on, let's get our facts right.
I've started as I mean to go on. Okay.
But Hilary Benn apparently had a line along his throat for the chopper, but managed to get out unscathed. But that didn't mean that a good number of people who have been very vocal against Corbyn's leadership, who were in the cabinet... they have been kicked out.
It seems there was only one main one, and even he isn't exactly a household name, is he? It's the... So Michael Duggar got kicked out, allegedly for what he said in relation to Labour's approach to terrorism and Islamic extremism more generally.
Tell the good listeners what he said, Jimmy.
So he made this comment in the House of Commons about how the approach of some unnamed people, that was obvious who he was referencing, was their criticism of Islamic terrorism was a bit infantilizing to the actual terrorists involved, and blamed it all on external factors and none on personal responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Which allegedly he was told when he was sacked that this was the reason for him being sacked, which prompted him to change his Twitter profile to sacked for...
Can we just say he has loved getting sacked?
Okay, he has
enjoyed this. So he then took to Twitter, which is absolute catnip for anybody in politics, apparently. And he's now changed his bio to MP for Barnsley East, sacked by Jeremy Corbyn for too much straight-talking, honest politics. Husband, dad, Beatles and co, obsessive. Which are obviously all of the most important things about him. But he's very happy to be branded the guy who, like, talked shit to Corbyn, right?
Well, this is probably the first time that anyone's actually written about him in the national press, I should imagine. Because what was his role, even, before he was sacked?
I'm not sure.
Do we know this? Does it matter? Does anybody care?
Oh my god. So he didn't even have like a really important role. He was the Shadow Culture Secretary.
Okay.
And didn't... that's quite harsh saying about the Culture Secretary. It's a very important part of politics. But you can't imagine somebody having that kind of a role if they're, you know, looking for to get power further down the line. Do you know what I mean?
Do you think...
I don't, like, it's so, for a very long time, it was, I feel like in many cabinet positions, it was seen as a role that was often given to a woman because that role...
Culture is a bit effeminate,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, and also it allowed them to kind of bump up the number of ministers that they had who were women without actually giving a lot of the really important roles to the ladies.
To be fair, if you're in the shadow cabinet, the only roles that really matter are leader and chancellor. And, you know, usually the other people don't really do anything of note. Nobody pays much attention to what they're saying.
Do you think that there was kind of like a retreat in how savage they wanted this reshuffle to be? Because it sounded like before Christmas that everybody was going to get that, at least Corbyn's team, while he wasn't in the country, actually, we should probably say, they were saying, oh yeah, this is going to be so savage, like we're going to make sure that...
I don't think it was Corbyn's team, I think it was Corbyn's critics who were saying that a revenge reshuffle...
Do you think so?
That was my impression of the press coverage. I also think the story that he was sacking Hillary Benn was just a good story.
And it would have been a great story.
It would have been a great story, but... And that's why I think a lot of journalists ran it. But whether they ever actually planned to sack Hillary Benn, I somewhat doubt, because I think, you know, the fallout would have been too great, potentially.
And yeah, but he keeps on being touted as a possible leader to kind of challenge Jeremy Corbyn. Can he risk that? Is it worth him risking going up against this guy who he's given such a prominent role, especially
Corbyn's
the politics that we have in the
moment? Corbyn's position is pretty impregnable anyway. He's got a huge mandate within the Labour Party. It's like it's actually higher than when he was elected, and it was 66% mm-hmm. when he was elected. They're managing to actually infiltrate all the different areas of the Labour apparatus.
Which is kind of terrifying, right? If you were like a Blairite right now in the Labour Party, I'd be packing my bags, I'd be giving up.
Well, people have said that the Blairites should leave, but the trouble is, if they leave in a trickle, they'll lose a lot of momentum, and then they'll mm-hmm. have to start back up again. What they need to do, if they want like an SDP-style split, is to organise among themselves and all leave en masse.
Yeah, but they won't do that, because the last time the SDP... So the SDP, for anybody who doesn't know, were a faction of Labour that decided that... In the 80s, if I'm correct.
Yeah, yeah.
Who decided that Labour had gone too far to the left, and they were like the social democrats of Labour.
Mm.
They went out and formed their own party. There were polls that suggested they were going to get a large number of seats in the next general election. They ended up only getting like 3 or 4, right?
Yeah,
and then they merged with the Liberal Democrats.
Yeah, they formed an alliance with the Liberals, and then I think it was those two together in one of the 80s elections very nearly was polling higher than Labour, and actually I think was polling higher than Labour at one point.
But because it failed so spectacularly,
it never translated into seats was mm-hmm. the problem. So,
but they failed so spectacularly that the chances of Labour doing that again are just so small. I don't think that they'd be that stupid. And Blairites are people who stayed in Labour, played the game for like 20 years until they were able to get into power on more of a social democrat thing. Don't you think that that's going to be more likely to be the route that they take? Or do you think that Corbyn and his team are going to be more... are going to end up being so ingrained in Labour as a party by the end of this 5 years that we think that he's going to be leader, that there's going to be no way and no like place for people who are like the centre-left rather than hard-left?
I think that Corbyn will stay, and I think we both now think he's going to last a couple of years. I think he's going to last until 2020. What happens after the election, where if he's still there, I think Labour will flop quite hard.
Mm-hmm.
That remains in dispute, although... I suppose the European referendum is still a bit of a wild card in this parliament. If we were to vote to leave, I think a lot of bets would be off the table as to what happens in domestic politics.
Yeah.
But say that we voted to stay in, which still seems the more likely option at this point, Corbyn makes it to 2020, they fail. Whether he stays on or not, I guess, depends on his internal support within the party. But bearing in mind that Labour failed in 2015... and they moved further to the left.
Mm-hmm.
If they fail again, will they necessarily think, oh, now it's time to move to the right? Probably not.
God knows. And it does terrify me, because we need, especially at the moment, I'm really conscious, and it's all about me, I'm very conscious of us having a lack of a credible opposition. And I think that that's... the Conservatives are very happy to run amok, and that terrifies me.
If the Lib Dems hadn't been in coalition, this would be a prime opportunity for them to actually move... back in and become the credible centre-left party. But obviously they've totally soiled their brand.
But there's only eight of them, and I'm not going to slag off Tim Farron again. I've done that too many times on this podcast. Why do you think that this reshuffle took such a long time?
You mean, why was it delayed over several days?
It's the longest reshuffle ever.
I don't know, really. I mean...
So, the reason I ask this is because Diane Abbott, there were some people who were suggesting that Hillary Benn was going to be sacked and replaced by Diane Abbott, and we'd have Diane Abbott in charge of foreign affairs, and that would have been amazing. It was kind of like the similar way that I felt about Sarah Palin possibly becoming vice president. I would have just loved to see the world go to shit.
I suppose if you see the Labour Party mostly as a vehicle for entertainment at this point, then you definitely want Diane Abbott somewhere at the top.
Yeah, and that's how I'm kind of reconciling the whole state of Labour at the moment. I'm just like, just buckle in and enjoy the ride for the next few years. It'll be fun. But basically, she justified the length of the reshuffle. It's because, Jeremy's just a really nice man, and he doesn't want to hurt people's feelings. And
surely the anxiety that's caused by lengthening it makes it worse. You want a nice clean cut, don't you?
Seven immediately. Rip off the plaster.
So you've got a very strong opinion about this whole debacle with the BBC, which I referenced in the intro.
Yeah.
Basically, there's a guy called Stephen Doughty.
Yeah.
And he resigned live on air, having been contacted by the BBC's political editor. And she knew that they were going to, that he was thinking of resigning. And there is the suggestion that she said to him, oh, if you're going to resign, you should come on our show and do it live on the Daily Politics, which is the BBC's daily political show, they've received quite a lot of criticism from this. Labour have made a formal complaint.
Yeah, there's a change.org petition.
So you're not too happy about this?
I'm not happy, but it's more of the Corbynites being like, oh my God, everybody's against us. Why is everybody being so mean? And that is really annoying me, because it makes me... Because I almost would like to get behind somebody like Jeremy Corbyn, and I would almost like to think, this is like a different leader that I don't necessarily agree with. In the same vein that I really respect somebody like Caroline Lucas, or I really respect somebody like Nicola Sturgeon, but I don't necessarily agree with their politics, I am coming to not respect the Corbyn grouping because of the way that they consistently throw their toys out of the pram and call foul play.
So do the SNP. The SNP, through multiple shit fits at Nick Robinson actually questioning the cult of Alex Salmond during the Scottish referendum.
Yeah, you're probably right, and it's probably not very salient for me because I'm not in Scotland.
Yeah.
But this is just how journalists work, and that's how broadcasts work. If you hear that somebody is thinking of doing something, you will offer them the biggest, and you think that it's going to be a big story, you offer them the biggest possible place to do it, but which would be the Daily Politics, this kind of thing.
There's two criticisms that are made of the BBC. Like, one, that it is partial to certain issues, which it probably is because of the sort of people it hires, and it has a public service mandate, which tends to lend itself to certain positions, even though they try very hard to maintain some sort of neutrality.
The amount of compliance that the BBC has to go through just makes me think that anybody that thinks that is ridiculous.
Oh no, I mean, it is true that the BBC is partial to certain things because it's a public sector broadcaster.
Yeah.
Certain people are more attracted to work in the public sector than, say, for The Sun. It just is inevitable. There's no way you can eliminate that bias entirely.
No, of course, but in terms of the broadcasters across the world, it is the most balanced that I am aware of.
I'd agree, but the other point is the other criticism that journalists make less often. I've heard Private Eye make this quite a few times, is that the BBC actually doesn't do enough original journalism. It actually often waits for Fleet Street to break stories and then jumps on the back of them because it feels, at that point, it's a major story and they can't ignore covering it. Whereas if they break the story themselves, there's a lot more chance that they'll be criticised for it as actually, you know, trying to pioneer some sort of agenda.
Mm-hmm. But I feel like the role that the BBC has is very much like, we are going to sit on our laurels a little bit and see what the facts are rather than break a story. I feel like they do that quite well.
It's partly that, but it's partly the compliance thing that that we just discussed. And it's been proved correct, because as soon as they actually break what is actually a smaller story than you'd think, given the furore around it, you know, they get criticised by a whole load of people. So there's reasons why they behave that way, but
What do you think? Because I think that this is the keyboard warriors of the Corbyn camp making a big fuss about nothing. What do you think about
that? I think there's some validity to their complaint, because the resignation of Doughty was timed just before Prime Minister's questions.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave it a political impact it otherwise wouldn't have happened. And the trouble with journalism, it's very hard to be neutral ultimately, because whenever you report on something, that affects how people perceive it, it affects what happens. And that's clearly what has happened in this instance. So I think, mate, there's probably an argument that they shouldn't have done it, actually, that they should have stayed out of this particular story.
I don't think
it's a huge issue, to be honest, but I certainly see why Labour are pissed off about it.
Do let us know what you think about this story, because we have missed you over the break and we'd love to tweet you. You can find us at Right Dishonour on Twitter, and you can also go to rightdishonourable.com and leave us a comment there. We do love it.
We do.
Leave us a comment. And also rate us on iTunes. Have I given too many calls to action now? I don't know. Oh my God, I'm panicking. Yeah.
So, Jezza, this week North Korea tested a nuclear bomb. What do we know about what happened?
Basically, there was an earthquake in North Korea that they are claiming is them testing a hydrogen bomb. So the important thing about them testing a hydrogen bomb is the fact that this particular type of nuclear weapon is a more powerful one that we would traditionally think of when we think of a nuclear weapon. I think that when most people think about these kinds of things, they think of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which were bombs that used nuclear fission, which is basically the splitting of atoms. And they are not as strong as what the Koreans are claiming that they are using, which is a fusion bomb, which is the bringing of atoms together, which tend to be 10 times more powerful than the fission equivalent.
So basically North Korea are claiming to have a far more powerful weapon than they really do have, we think.
I mean, the reason that a fusion bomb is a lot more scary is because they can be a lot smaller. Something like the big boy bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima, that was like a huge, massive, like as big as like an apartment. Whereas a fusion bomb can be fitted to the front of a missile and therefore has a much further range in terms of who the North Koreans could potentially attack.
So roughly where do they think North Korea could attack if we're looking at, say, the western seaboard of the US?
If it's a fusion bomb, potentially, if they have the right rocket capabilities, the western seaboard of the US.
So San Francisco,
yeah, San Francisco, LA, Seattle, if they're feeling so inclined. However, by the amount that people have been measuring the earthquake, people seem to think that this isn't actually a H-bomb.
It wouldn't be like North Korea to lie about this sort of thing, would it?
No, not at all. But they basically said that, yes, this is basically us showing that this is our military might, but generally you would assume that a fusion bomb would have probably 10 times the amount of effect on on the Richter scale than what was actually measured last week.
So it's actually pretty common for North Korea to, you know, demonstrate alleged military might in one form or another. Usually it's by firing, yeah, stuff at the South Korean military and, you know, deliberately missing because there's a sense they don't really want to provoke a war, but they just want to appear to be tough.
Yeah.
Is anything particularly different about this situation compared to similar ones we've had last year?
The reason that this has become such a big story is because of the fact that it could possibly be a fusion bomb. So there's not a chance there's a low chance that this is going to be a hydrogen bomb in its purest sense, but there's a possibility that it's some kind of a hybrid, and they can be particularly scary, especially for its neighbours, South Korea, Japan, to a lesser extent China, but specifically Japan and South Korea would have probably a terrible time if North Korea decided to throw around their military might a little bit more.
So, what do you think the US and Japan and South Korea are actually going to do about this, if anything?
I mean, the US is only involved in this specific conflict because of the treaties that it has with South Korea and Japan.
Well, there's a sense that the US is trying to contain China more generally because it's worried about China projecting its influence further into, say, the East and South China Seas.
But what's really interesting with this particular kind of, dynamic that you have between those five nations is that China is the only one that actually has any kind of diplomatic relations with North Korea. Mm. And so if you're trying to talk them down from some kind of nuclear war, the Chinese are the ones that you want on your side to be able to do that. And so I think that this is my personal opinion, the only way that you're going to be able to kind of bring these powers together to have some kind of armistice, unless you want some kind of a war, you need to have them sitting around a table. And nobody is willing to do that with North Korea. And North Korea, to be fair, are also unwilling to do that with the South, with Japan, and with the USA.
So it's kind of just a stalemate type situation.
Huge stalemate. And I don't think that I don't think that people are genuinely scared that North Korea is going to use a nuclear weapon. However, if they get super desperate, God knows.
I mean, do you see it happening?
No, I don't think that that could possibly happen. Because I think that also there's... So South Korea is meant to have very good intelligence in North Korea. And it doesn't... And I think that they would probably want for there to be some kind of an invasion from south to north before there was any kind of nuclear kind of
exchange.
Option. Yeah, yeah. Nuclear exchange.
Exchange.
Well, the thing is, it's only the US and China who also have nuclear weapons in that kind of five-nation...
And Japan has a pacifistic constitution, at least, for the moment.
Yeah, but they do love to contest ownership of islands with the Chinese, loads.
Yeah.
So I've never really understood what Japan means by a pacifist constitution.
Well, I think it was part of the demilitarisation,
yeah,
post-World War II, but... And there has been some pushback from Shinzo Abe over it in recent years.
The Japanese Prime Minister.
Japanese Prime Minister. The thing that baffles me about the whole North Korea situation is I'm not really sure what China has to gain by propping up North Korea. Because to a great extent, North Korea continues to exist because China lets them exist. If they decided that they didn't want North Korea to exist anymore...
I think a lot of it is to do with history of being on the communist side of the Cold War. And so growing up, China also traditionally was very sceptical of places like South Korea and Japan. And there's also... everybody in Asia hates Japan because, you know,
Japan are dicks.
World War II happened and nobody's bloody apologised.
They actually did apologise recently, though, over the comfort woman
thing. Yeah, but they still go and pray at the tombs of people who are war criminals. And it does leave a terrible taste in the rest of Asia's mouth. I think that is the main reason that China has...
So it's a kind of sentimental thing, almost, then.
To a certain extent, yeah. I wouldn't call it sentimental. I mean, I'd call it kind of like an overhang of strong communist China.
But is there a strategic advantage to them continuing to keep North Korea alive? Because the alternative is that North Korea collapses as a state or is reintegrated back into South Korea as a greater Korean state.
Correct. And I think long-term there have... It's been long suggested that that is what the Chinese want. They want preferably a peaceful kind of reunification of Korea under southern governance.
But South Korea is a lot closer to the US than it is to China.
It is, yeah, and that's probably the reason that it hasn't been allowed to happen yet. But also, we should probably say that the Chinese are the only people who could possibly sway North Korea to do anything diplomatically at all. And so keeping them on side is probably the only thing that is stopping there being... like all out, I was going to say total war then, but then I just think of the video game. But being like all out, having all out war between the US and its allies and North Korea.
The thing is, I don't think if the US decided to, I suppose that this could go any way really, but if the US wanted to, they could occupy North Korea within a matter of days, couldn't they?
Yeah, but then if they... because they do have some kind of nuclear capability and nobody's 100% sure what it actually is, it's a button.
I mean, that's
the terrifying.
That is a great argument for having a nuclear weapon, I suppose, if you're a small state.
Yeah, no,
I mean,
true.
Nuclear deterrence does work.
So we should actually, in case we ever decide to have, like, a crazy, like, dictatorial regime in the UK, we should keep Trident, just so that we can continue being crazy.
I'm just saying, if we leave the EU, we should keep the nukes, just in case the EU decides they want to fuck with us one day.
Yeah, screw you, Germany. Come at me, bro.
Do you have anything else to say about this?
Yeah, we're all going to die. It's been lovely knowing you all.
I mean, we do have one more topic, so...
Oh, right, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Come at us for that, too. Follow us on Twitter. Jimmy, you wrote an article.
I did, yeah.
Well done.
Do you know what that is? Have you ever written one yourself?
I've written one article on the website, and it was really good... And so I've been really scared to kind of, you know, submit something else and it for not, like...
This is the second album syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm going to do an Adele and wait another, like, 5 years before I actually release anything else. But basically, you wrote an article about Fat Cat Tuesday. Please explain to me what Fat Cat Tuesday is, because you've just put a picture of a kitten at the top of the website.
It's not particularly fat either, as it goes.
No, it's quite fluffy.
It's overweight. Fat Cat Tuesday is, as I said in the introduction to this podcast, it's the period of time that lapses in, like, the working year before a FTSE 100 chief executive has made the average British salary. So in this case, it's £27,000, basically. If you're a chief executive of a FTSE 100 company, which is basically the top 100 companies in Britain... Mm-hmm. Because it's an index that tracks the wealthiest companies in the
world. I just had in my head the
thought
of doing like a countdown, like Top of the Pops. We should do that one day.
Yeah, maybe. But if you were paid at an hourly rate and you're one of those chief executives and you worked 3 out of 4 weekends, you worked 12-hour days, they worked at like an hourly rate, and it doesn't take you very long before you've made £27,000. And the reason this is apparently outrageous is because, you know, some people make more money than other people, and the new year is a great time to recognise that fact.
How long did it take? How many days?
So Monday, the reason it's Tuesday is it takes till Tuesday afternoon for them to make an average British salary.
So it was like a day and a half.
Yeah, I mean, they released a similar report last year, the High Pay Centre, which is the think tank that put this together.
Yeah.
And Last year, I think it was Fat Cat Wednesday. So it's actually...
Fat Cat Tuesday has a better alliteration.
It does. It does have a better ring to it. But they're trying to say, because they use the same statistical method to work out... it means that inequality has actually gone up, although for quite a lot of reasons, this is quite a poor measure of inequality in general.
So this is something that I don't think that we've talked about before, but do you particularly care about inequality?
That's a bit of a loaded question, isn't it?
Is it?
In terms of, like, people earning, you know, am I like Peter Mandelson? Do I give a shit about people becoming filthy rich? No, I don't care in and of itself. There are, however... As far as I can tell, there are economic factors that you do need to consider when you're discussing inequality. I mean, I think some people do harder work than other types of people. I think some people just generate more value. Mm-hmm. If you look at the sort of the background to the High Pay Centre, you look on their website, they talk about pay in terms of... So they compare, like, a hard-working nurse in one of Britain's busiest hospitals against some CEO who appears not ready to do anything if you actually watch that video. And the way people are paid, people are not paid in terms of how skilled they are or how well-educated they are. They're paid in, roughly in terms
how
of...
How much money they...
Generate. How much value they generate. And...
But do we want that when we... So we have junior doctors deciding to strike.
Sure.
Is it next week? Or it's very soon,
it's soon
at least.
Yeah.
Because I don't think there's many people that would dispute that a doctor's job is an incredibly important one, but it doesn't generate an awful lot of wealth in and of itself.
Well, I think one of the problems with our economic system is that it doesn't recognise certain things that are valuable, but things that people aren't necessarily willing to pay for.
When you say economic system, do you mean, like, capitalism in general?
Capitalism in general. And this isn't an original criticism of capitalism, but capitalism is good at generating wealth in terms
of... we'll pretend it is.
In terms of stuff. In terms of, like, generating new technology, etc. What it is bad at is allocating wealth, basically. And it means that, I mean... You know, a rare time where I'm actually on the same side as the feminist, but capitalism really, like, undermines stuff like childcare and stuff like that, which it doesn't pay well because it doesn't generate any immediate value. But obviously, that you then create a demographic time bomb. So yeah. there's lots of malign effects from the way our system works. And people have argued, I don't know the extent to which this is true, but that if inequality grows too large. It creates inefficiencies in the system because when poorer people get money, they tend to spend it on stuff which generates further economic activity. When richer people collect money, sometimes they invest it, but sometimes they just hoard it.
Yeah.
And that therefore locks up
that money. Or they'll invest it in something like the property market, which...
Yeah, which is an added problem,
yeah.
Right? So I think those arguments are compelling in terms of inequality. I think the whole thing of...
So this is kind of like the argument versus Natalie Bennett, the leader of the Green Party, saying, oh, but it just makes people feel sad when they have people who are around them who are more rich.
I don't think that's an irrelevant point, although it's very hard to... That you get into this whole argument of like, okay, we have too much inequality. How much is enough inequality?
Yeah.
How much is an okay amount? And I think someone like Natalie Bennett would always say, we have too much. Mm-hmm. Like, it wouldn't matter how much inequality we had. And from my point of view, if people are free to do business and free to live their own lives, inevitably you're going to generate income inequality.
Mm-hmm.
That's assuming that you still have a capitalist system. I don't think we're at anywhere near having a different system from that. So if you're working within capitalism and you want freedom, you need some amount of economic inequality. Mm-hmm. The whole, like, esteem thing, I think, is true. There is actually a book... also, which argues that inequality, more like less equal societies, tend to have higher crime rates and higher rates of illness.
A la London riots, I suppose, would be kind of like the
But it's also
example of that.
It's more that if you're impoverished communities in general tend to generate more crime,
yeah.
And it's partly the psychological thing of resentment. But the book is called, like, Why Equality is Better for Everyone, because it argues that even if you're rich, if you live in a more equal society, you have better health, access to better healthcare, and you're less in danger of being mugged and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I didn't find
But do you think that that's an argument that can sway opinions, though?
No, because because a lot of it is to do with more like primitive ideological factors. I think about equality, like people have this idea of, well, I work and to generate my money, and therefore that's my money. I'm going to end up sounding really left wing, which is
again, yeah, which is very odd. Again, rare. Shall I try and balance this out and sound quite right wing?
Okay, go ahead.
So I grew up in Essex, and as such,
the home of Thatcherism.
So, everybody that I grew up with benefited from the free market in some way, shape or form, or at least their families did. A lot of people I went to school with now work in the city in some capacity, and generate huge amounts of money and generate a lot of taxation, to the extent where when I met up with a couple of people over Christmas that I used to go to school with, one of them said a line along the lines of, When I went into a hospital and I looked at like the MRI scanner, and was like, yeah, I paid for that last week with my taxes. And I was like, okay, you're a douchebag, but that's right. Well, you know, the wealth that you have generated.
MRI machines are fucking expensive. I very much doubt that he paid for like even a thousandth of that machine as his taxes.
This was the claim he was making.
I mean, I call bullshit. No, I don't think that's true.
I'll tell you what, I'll get back to him and I'll tell him to give me the figures and I'll let you know. But that is I feel like that is a legitimate point. If you have people who are getting stinking rich, make sure that they end up paying taxes and don't go through loopholes and aren't able to use loopholes to avoid paying tax. Make sure that people who do get stinking rich end up contributing to the rest of society.
I think the neoliberal doctrine has made that quite difficult because it's very easy for people to move their money around. And there's a lot of...
Which is the problem.
There's a lot of offshore places and places like Luxembourg, which frankly have nothing else really going for them in terms of industry other than they can lower their tax rate and get companies to move their tax bases to there as opposed to...
Dublin.
Well, yeah, also Dublin. although Dublin, that's kind of unfair on Dublin because Dublin does have other things going for it, industrially speaking. But
great.
But yeah, I feel there's a lot more problems around inequality than the actual headline figure of, look, these guys make so much more money than you per year. I don't really see that as the main problem in and of itself.
But I feel like there's a lot of noise that says specifically that, and I don't think that that is really the issue. The issue that these people that generate a lot of money and are very wealthy, the problem is that they then don't pay back into society, despite the fact that they have benefited from the systems that are already in place, like the NHS, like the fact that they have co-workers and employees that are educated, like the fact that we have science funding that makes us leaders in particular fields.
I agree, yeah.
I feel like that's the problem, rather than the fact that somebody has earned as much as I earn in a year in like 4 days.
Yeah, I mean, there's an element like even the name Fat Cat Tuesday sort of, this is like the left's version of racism. It's like, we'll just stir up a bit of hatred of rich people as opposed to
immigrants. I think that's a long shot calling it the left's version of racism.
I didn't say it was as bad. It just is the left's version of racism.
Right, okay, fine.
of scapegoating.
Good. How can we fix this?
I don't think...
Is it something that should be fixed? Why do we even pay attention to Fat Cat Tuesday?
The only way you can fix something like the corporate taxation problem that you pointed out is actually to have like a global forum on it and agree some sort of standards. Mm. The chances of that happening are less than zero at this point. Although we did manage to advance on the climate change issues, so I guess anything's possible.
Oh yeah, that's definitely going to go fantastically well, isn't it?
It finished better than people thought it would, so I guess that's okay.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
I think it's... I think
we all just need to move to higher land, frankly. I've given up.
Why do you
think I live on the sixth floor?
I mean, yeah, I don't know that's going to work out well for you.
It's going to be great. It's going to be fine.
Do you have anything else to say about inequality?
No.
If you have anything to say about inequality, you can tweet us, write us on the website, stalk Jazza on Facebook. You know, the opportunities are endless.
You can find me at Jazza John, and you can find Jimmy at
JDE Nichols.
Thank you very much. We've missed you. Love us. Bye.